Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. His blog of twominds.com has logged over 55 million page views, probably more by now, and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance site. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Well, that's an introduction that's going to be hard to live up to. So, I'm a beginner here. We're just exploring interesting topics. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have all the answers, but we have some interesting topics.
Great insight as always. And last time we talked about the commercial real estate bubble, and we thought today we'd do a special focus on the millennial generation and how financial repression, through repressed interest rates and quantitative easing, has resulted in asset bubbles that ultimately have affected the millennial generation in terms of their values and how they look at the economy and life and their the way they're conducting themselves in the economy. What they're facing in terms of the housing market and the job situation.
Right. And, Richard, it's hard to know where to start, but I think we could profitably start with the basic context of the economy and the millennial generation. And so in terms of financial repression, the key sector that we need to look at is student loan debt, right? Because so many millennials are carrying student loan debt, and a small student loan debt is like $25,000-$30,000, right? If somebody can escape with a bachelor's diploma and only have $30,000 in debt, they've considered to be done quite well. But when you think about it, that's a pretty large debt for somebody that it doesn't even have a full-time job yet.
Yeah. My figure was 13,000, I think, when I came out, 13,500.
Wow, that was very low.
Yeah.
Nowadays, 10 times that's not uncommon, especially if you go to graduate school. We all know why this is, but it's worth touching on, because the financial repression part is when the central state, the central government and its central bank, when the central state guarantees any sort of lending, right, where a lender can't lose money because the government will step in and cover any losses.
Yeah.
Well, then there's a huge incentive to lend out, to marginal borrowers, right? Mm-hmm. And to really push every loan you can. And that's exactly what we have with student loans, right? It's like anybody that is breathing can get a student loan, and an immense amount. And then these are non-recourse loans, right? Talk about financial repression. They're not, you can't take them to bankruptcy court or reduce them in any way, short of a few government programs, such as if you join the government service and then you get a reduction and so on. So it's like the financial system on financial repression steroids. And so they've really tasted the worst of neoliberal banking, right? The interest rates on student loans are not that low. Sometimes they're as high as 7.5%, 8.5%. And then the higher education system, which is supposed to be concerned with educating the youth, have just gorged on these on all this free money, right? Built fabulous buildings on campus and hired I mean, the administration, I just looked at a statistic. The number of administrators in higher education in America went up 34-fold in like 30 years, wow. Where the number of students barely rose, right? And so, yeah. Or that was much more modest. And so, yeah. Anyways, this is like the worst possible combination of financial repression and state guarantees. And so the millennials have that burden on them right from the start.
Yeah, just trying to get out of the gate in terms of, you know, maybe leaving the nest or getting a family formation. You know, how can they do that, right? How can they buy maybe a home or a car? Just getting out, right? A lot of them have difficulty even getting a job, even given the large amount of debt, you know, to begin with.
Right. And then, you know, you sent me several interesting articles talking about the impact of the last decade's financial stagnation on the millennial frame of mind or their value system. And of course, a lot of them grew up seeing their parents under a lot of financial stress during the, you know, the bubble pop global financial meltdown in 2008 and 9. And so this has made them wary of debt. And again, just for context, there's a consumer debt is just continues to climb, you know. And this, of course, is mostly people that are older than their early 20s. It's hard for them to acquire much more debt than their student loan debt. But I have a chart here from the St. Louis Fed, and it's the total consumer credit owed and securitized, and it shows a minor dip in the 2009 time frame, and then it's rocketed even higher. You know, it's rocketed another 1.2 trillion. So I think that the millennials are well aware that the entire system, not just the student loans that they're under, but the entire system is incredibly burdened with debt.
And so how is this resulting in their views, their values, how they're growing up, and you know, what they see as the prospects for jobs, and just you know, where to live in general? You know, does it make sense to live in the inner city or out in the suburbs, exurbs?
Right. Well, one of the essays you sent me was an excerpt from Mark Faber's recent essay, kind of exploring the concept that the millennial generation is much more risk averse, because and we can see why, because they've seen the damage and the stress and the losses that can result from taking on way too much debt and not having enough income or collateral to support that debt. So they're obviously wary of taking on these gigantic mortgages that their parents did, and buying new cars, and, you know, adding debt on top of debt on top of debt. And so I think as a generalization, they're less willing to take the risk of taking on a gigantic mortgage. And I mean by that, you know, in the $700,000-$800,000 range, right? Yeah. Like you and I were speaking, you know, $1 million house in Toronto or Vancouver or Seattle or the San Francisco Bay Area or Boston, you know, you name it. Yeah. I mean, $1 million, you have to put down about $250,000. And so you're on the hook for $750,000. That's a lot of money. And so that risk aversion, it carries several potential consequences. One that was being discussed in the essay was that there's less entrepreneurial activity because for the same reason. You know, why risk everything on a business that might fail?
Yeah. I mean, the millennial generation is the least entrepreneurial of all, was a quote from that article.
Right. And that's at odds with the sort of tech hub kind of environment in which the assumption is, here's a bunch of 23-year-olds or 25-year-olds starting a billion-dollar company, you know, in the living room. But that's actually like just the bleeding edge of a generation that is generally risk averse. And so then we go look at housing, right? And I submitted a couple of charts that showed that two of the millennials' favorite cities, at least by judging by surveys of where you'd like to move after you graduate from college, Seattle and Portland are quite high on that list. And those, according to the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, those two cities now have exceeded the 2007 bubble in terms of housing valuation. And I think that there's just many other favored cities, cities that are attractive to millennials, like Austin, Texas, and San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, there's a lot of other places that are exhibiting the same kind of enormous home valuation bubbles or expansions, to the point that only the top earners can afford that. And so then that raises the question, well, what are the millennials going to do? And Joel Kotkin, who's a demographer, as well, studies demographics and the economy. His view is millennials do want to buy and own homes, but they are only willing to do so if they can afford them. And so that basically eliminates most of the really super desirable core cities. City centers of Seattle, Portland, Austin, San Francisco, and so on. And so, in Boston, Brooklyn, Manhattan, So, where do they go to buy a home? And, his theory, he proposed that they were willing to move to the suburbs, because if that's where it's affordable. But I think my question on that is, I don't think that suburban homes in super desirable urban areas like Greater Seattle and around Austin, around the San Francisco Bay Area, those houses are not much cheaper than the core houses. So I'm not sure that that's really an opportunity. So I kind of think that the opportunities, at least in North America, are in smaller cities, in the range of 50 to 100,000, maybe a quarter million residents, as not like these megalopolis, right? The only millennial I know that, I know a few millennials, that have purchased homes. One, bought a house in Portland. And I think it was around 400,000, 450, and they both work, and they had a condo that they'd purchased a while ago, so they had some equity. And then another millennial bought a house in Columbus, Ohio, which is a classic college town in the Midwest, upper Midwest, for less than $50,000. Wow. Now this was not a large house, right?
Yeah.
And it was an old house, and it needed a little work and all that. But I mean, we're talking about a house for less than $50,000, roughly a tenth of the values of these, hot, desirable core cities.
Mm-hmm.
So that raises some interesting investment questions about where the millennials are going to go and where is real estate going to be desirable to them.
Yeah, and it also factors in to who are the baby boomers going to sell to, right? Because if there's nobody there or no demand to buy these houses due to, lack of income or insufficient income, that could also pose some challenges to baby boomers looking to sell their house nest egg.
Right. I think that's a huge demographic question that I haven't seen any really good statistics on, because, of course, most of the boomers are still in their late 50s or 60s, early 70s, and they're not yet to the point where the older generation, like the boomers' parents, the so-called silent generation, which has sold their houses or given them to their offspring, their adult children. And so, but we're talking about such huge numbers. And just for context, in general, roughly two-thirds of the baby boom generation owns homes, right? And so there's, 65%, low 60s. So there's a large percentage of the boomers who own homes, And typically they bought these homes when they were younger and had families. And so there's going to be a huge incentive for them as they age to unload these houses, right?
Yeah.
And in the good old days when there was more family wealth, they might have been able to afford to basically just give that house to their children and then retire somewhere else on their income.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the cost of retirement so high, and I know because, you know, I'm 63 and I have, my mom is in a retirement home. And so I know that, I mean, if you can get in for $4,000 or $5,000 a month to an assisted living, that's quite reasonable. And it can go as high as $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 a month.
Yeah.
So almost everybody facing that kind of sum of money is going to have to sell their house in order to, you know, liquidate their equity in order to retire on that. So they're not going to be able just to hand the keys to their adult children. So that's a question that I don't think we know the answer to. But if millennials can't buy the boomer's house at the current value, then basic supply and demand economics suggests that prices will have to fall to the point at which they're affordable to millennials, which in many areas is going to would suggest a 50% drop, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they may be initially thinking perhaps I'll just, you know, get the house through inheritance and therefore I can focus my current income on, you know, things like coffee at Starbucks and looking for trips to Machu Picchu or something, you know, Patagonia. This is where their values and emphasis seems to be. So they might be saying, well, let me just spend that money there and then I'll eventually get the house. But the house is now likely going to be needed for retirement by the baby boomers, is what you're saying.
Right. And so they won't be able to inherit. They're going to, the parents are going to be selling that house in order to extract the equity to retire on or downsize. And in which case they'll be competing with their children for affordable housing, right? That's like small apartments and that kind of thing. So the other key element here is what can we expect in the future for millennial incomes? And every indication that we have currently, statistically, is that millennials are making considerably less money at the same age compared to the Gen X and boomers made in their early to mid 20s and early 30s.
Yeah.
And so, and what we do see is a great concentration, a skewing of national income to the top 1% and 5%, right? I mean, this is well established that the top 5%, what we might call the technocrat professional entrepreneurial class, is their income is continuing to grow ahead of inflation and expenses, but everybody else below that is their income is stagnating. And so I don't think that it would be I don't think there's any evidence at this point to presume that the millennials are going to suddenly at some magical point in the future start making a lot more money and be able to afford overvalued, you know, housing. I just don't, there's no evidence for that. You know, all the trends are the opposite, stagnating incomes and a millennial income trend that will stay subpar below that of previous generations for decades to come. So I don't think there's any magic bullet on that. And if we look at what's the other magic bullet in financial repression, armory. Well, it's lowering interest rates to zero. Hey, we've been there for 8 years, right?
Yeah.
Or near zero. And mortgage rates, below 4% were at, you know, basically unprecedented lows and they're starting to, click back up above four and hit 4 or 4.5. So we've already used up all that ammunition about lowering interest rates to near zero to push mortgages down to make, very overvalued homes affordable. That's done, right? In fact, the trend suggests that we're at a bottom there and mortgage rates may continue to click higher and put another sort of pressure on the incomes of millennials.
Yeah, so the repressed interest rates is sort of affecting a large number of age groups because the inability to get sufficient income off of fixed income assets and investments as baby boomers retire, right, looking maybe more to go into bonds or fixed income type of investments with the interest rates being so low, that's very difficult. And, you know, therefore, you know, maybe you go to the house and reverse mortgage and all that. But at the same time, that's all, you know, secondarily affecting the millennial generation as well. So there's not much discussion in that regard, you know, how repressed interest rates have negatively affected the millennial generation.
That's right. That's right. And if you're a borrower, if you are a saver, then of course you're receiving very little income, and that's hurt the older generations, which have been saving money for their retirement. But the millennials, who are the borrowers of student loans and auto loans and so on, the other than the teaser rates that have been offered for auto loans, if you're paying a student loan or a credit card, I mean, the interest rates are sky high still. They're very high. You know, as we know, credit cards are quite often 15-16%. And so the millennials aren't really getting an enormous benefit from the so-called zero rates because much of their debt is not at 1%. Yeah, you can get a 1% auto loan if you qualify.
Yeah.
But if you're the most of the debt that's out there is at much higher rates.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and Richard, maybe one of the key questions here going forward is what happens to the United States and perhaps we could include Canada with at least in the high value cities of Toronto and Vancouver, where young people that just have regular normal income jobs are priced out of buying a single family home in those areas. What happens to the society and the economy when people can't afford to buy a home, that they're just renters? I mean, what impact does that have socially, economically, and politically?
Yeah.
I don't think we've really we haven't really explored that too much. And what Joel Kotkin was arguing against was the idea that the millennials will be perfectly happy to be renters their whole lives. And he was suggesting that, well, maybe that's just a happy story without any actual basis, you know, that maybe they'll be quite angry that they can't afford to buy a house.
Right. Yeah. Just and the sense of ownership that goes along with that. I mean, there's some other points that go to that regard in that Mark Farber article where he references a number of authors. So that we talked before about the risk aversion that's infecting even now corporate America, you know, in terms of in the old days, there was budgets for doing research and development, and now it's being, you know, more money is spent on legal compliance and human resources instead, you know, and less on training, less on research and development. That's also leading related to the fall in entrepreneurial activity, innovation, Mark quotes Edward Gibbon in terms of how it ended up like in Athens in Greece in the ancient history, where in the end more than they wanted freedom, they wanted security. When the Athenians finally wanted not to give to society, but for society to give to them, when the freedom they wished for was freedom from responsibility, then Athens ceased to be free. And so that is a big issue, you know, in terms of what could happen, you know, resulting from the spirit of risk aversion and a sense of greater entitlement, you know, from the government.
Yes, that's an excellent point, Richard. And kind of following that up, Joel Kotkin also mentioned that there's a generational conflict brewing in like land use and how we provide housing, how we build housing, and that as we all know that the last I'd say 20 some years has been dominated by NIMBYism, like not in my backyard, right? Don't build any new housing. Don't build any high density housing. You know, don't build a new, a complex by my house, right?
Yeah.
And so that has really stifled construction in a lot of cities, especially those with, you know, very little open land left. And then, of course, the local governments have raised the fees on building, and so it can cost, I think the number that he mentioned was $50,000 per unit just for the development costs, you know, the permits and the sewer connection, and you know, there's a $10,000 fee for everything, right?
Yeah.
For each item.
Wow.
And so, if it costs $50,000 just to get a permit, basically, before you've even spent a dollar on the land, and then the whole process is dragged out, so you spend 2 years, basically paying interest and principal on the land you purchased before you actually get permission to build. All these things have made it so. The housing that is built is super unaffordable. And so if we're going to look at the millennial sort of tendency, some people say, towards socialism, like, well, the government is the entity that can fix this. If we look at what the government has done with housing, for instance, rent control has been a disaster because that immediately kills off any new construction. And reduces the incentive for landowners, you know, and landlords to maintain the property because their income is fixed. And the other thing that the government has done, in response to this affordable housing crisis is it's built so-called affordable housing, but that is only in the vast majority of cases, that is merely subsidized housing. In other words, it still costs $250,000 to build that tiny apartment, you know, per unit. And then the taxpayer subsidizes $150,000 of it, making it affordable. But that's only a subsidy. They didn't actually do anything to lower the cost of construction or ownership. And so obviously there's extreme limits on that kind of thing. And so many cities end up patting themselves on the back for building like 400 units,
yeah.
You know, because the subsidy cost is so extreme. And so maybe what the millennials could do, and I don't know if there's any potential for this, but if they took a political voice, they might do better than instead of demanding the government build subsidized housing that's just adds burden to the taxpayers. Maybe they could overturn a lot of these super restrictive codes and NIMBYism, you know, that is choking the construction of new, more affordable housing.
Yeah, I think, the regulation issue is big, and it's also affecting, like, if you look at the positive side of some of what's happening, like this, you know, move towards tiny houses where you have these, you know, maybe 160 to, you know, 1,000 square feet type, very, very small houses that can be almost like mobile homes.
That's right.
That's and then that maybe the retrofitting also of dying malls to have them, you know, go into housing, you know, to housing developments to be retrofitted from malls. Other things like containers that are being, you know, retrofitted into houses as well, all of that. But there's a lot of regulations in many communities that prohibit that type of thing to happen, you know, in terms of putting these tiny houses on property.
That's right. There has to be a change in, as you say, the regulatory sort of spirit of the law.
Yeah.
And that's a political process. But, you know, just Richard, to speak briefly on an investment potential here, like where is there an opportunity here for people that want to participate in this huge demographic, you know, economic housing shift we're talking about? Well, from just anecdotally, I can't give you national statistics, but just from people I talk to, it seems like the opportunity is in these small cities that have some assets. You know, in other words, they have a port. You know, they're on the seacoast, or they have a riverfront, or they have some state universities. These kinds of assets that are tend to be institutional or profoundly economic. Those small cities seem to be where the millennials can afford and where they're interested in revitalizing. I was speaking with another blogger, podcaster, and he was saying that Buffalo, New York, which was for quite a few years considered a poster child for urban decay, right? Yeah. Upstate New York. And he said it's actually becoming a happening place because young people are moving there and opening brew pubs and because it's cheap. And so I think the key here is to find places where housing and commercial space, to open a restaurant or a cafe or some sort of business. If you can find a place with super cheap rent, super cheap housing you can buy for like I said, in a neighborhood of $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, and then that's going to be a magnet for young people for the affordability. And as we all know, the trend from for many decades has been, the artists and the creative types will go to a rundown neighborhood or town, and then they will revitalize it because it's affordable to them. And so that may be the opportunity going forward, is in smaller cities that have some assets that and by that I mean compared to a place that was dependent on one auto assembly plant, right? And so when the plant closes, the whole place is shut down, and there's no other assets to draw upon. But if you have institutions like then there's some foundation there that can support a revitalization. And so I'm just, people have told me, that Buffalo, New York seems to have some magnet potential, and Columbus, Ohio, yep, as two examples, and I'm sure there's many others, dozens. Yeah. And so that's where I would, if I were a real estate investor, I'd start looking at places like that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And that's also consistent with the trend towards a move to the center, the so-called flyover America, land between the coasts in the interior, in the Midwest, where, there was places that have been very depressed, Buffalo, maybe Detroit, very, very low cost. And, the cost base is already beginning from a very low point. But at the same time, you've got resources. You've got land, arable land that for agriculture potential, and then the potential for fiscal spending on infrastructure. So you got the Midwest, that has the potential there, where it's traditionally played a role. So that sort of whole manufacturing, infrastructure, agriculture, in the interior of the U.S., that trend, and certainly people, moving out of California for various reasons, and high cost areas, highly taxed areas, going more towards the favorable areas in the interior.
Yes, absolutely. And you mentioned agriculture and arable land. Well, I also just I don't know them personally, but through other millennials I know, it turns out there's quite a few millennials who are homesteading. In other words, they're buying abandoned farms, or they're buying rural land and starting to raise pigs and chickens again, the cost is so much lower. And I want to make a last point here, which is this could be a global trend. In other words, it may not be isolated to the U.S. or North America, because I know, again, anecdotally, that there's evidence of this in Japan, which is highly urbanized, highly expensive, basically housing's unaffordable in Kanto Plain, around Tokyo, that there's millennials there who are just giving up their full-time job, moving to these abandoned villages, or almost abandoned. There's only a few, old people left.
Yeah.
And they're renting these beautiful old farm homes for like $200 a month, including the land around it, starting to garden. And then they're working part-time online, right? Yeah. Because a lot of them have, they're illustrators or they're graphic design or they're programmers. And so that's that other aspect of our economy that what I call the emerging economy, or what a lot of people call the, fourth industrial revolution, the digital economy, for a lot of young people with technical skills, they can work anywhere. So yeah. they can exactly. actually afford to live in a small town that's super cheap, and just work part time online. So that there's a lot of positive things that the government can't destroy here with overregulation. And there may be ways to get around the damage of the financial repression, and so anyways, those are the potential positives.
Yeah, exactly. Ending on a positive note, that through some type of regulatory reform process, as we discussed earlier, together with innovative ideas on housing in terms of tiny houses, container housing, retrofitted malls, with the trend of working at home, telecommuting, internet, online-based businesses, the whole retail sector, malls dying, but everybody setting up, businesses that are online through Amazon or Shopify, that's the positive trend to allow a more affordable housing and opportunities.
That's right. That's a good summary, Richard, because if it's not affordable, it's not going to work for the millennials. They're not interested in overextending themselves on debt. And so it has to be affordable. And that's where the opportunity is for everybody that wants to be part of this, I think, is to provide affordable retail space and affordable housing and get in on that, as you say, with things like tiny homes and maybe my final comment would be the local governments, the local city governments and the county governments who get in on this are going to prosper. The ones who allow tiny homes and make it easy for young people to start businesses, low costs, low fees, they're going to prosper. And everybody who's in this high, regulatory barrier, high cost, high expenses, overregulation, they're going to die. Yeah. And we already see that. And I'd say Chicago is probably a good prospect for a city on the way down from too many expenses and overregulation. So, yeah.
Exactly. Well, that's great insight, Charles. And how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com.
Great. And we'll do another session on another topic in about a month.
Yes, looking forward to it.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.